Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. And while we are indeed on Black People Time and slightly late, we are nevertheless here now, baby, as our friends of African American descent are fond of saying. And with me here tonight, I have Carl Thorburn, a Block regular. Carl, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm feeling particularly black right now, so I think it's good that we're a little late.
Exactly. I have just finished eating a watermelon, and I am going to move on to fried chicken.
I had fried chicken for lunch, actually.
Yeah. Stay black, my Negro, while I rattle off all of our important financial information. Now, of course, a couple of black ass niggers like us needs money to fund our black activities, and so and of course the posse,
our black activities.
Of course, I'm sorry. This is just so unprofessional. I don't know if I should cut it out in post-production or should the people listening to the replay also listen to these delicious bands. But in any case, yes, our Blacktivities need some financing. The posse over at Countercurrents can be financed through Entropy. And you can donate through Entropy to Countercurrents, and this allows you to ask our black asses some questions as well. And yeah, of course, to keep us well-heeled with fried chicken and watermelons, you can also donate through Cash App. Now, you can't ask questions or give comments through Cash App, but you can always give us money out of the goodness of your heart, and there's always MoonPay. Now, MoonPay allows you to use your credit card to convert your fiat currency into cryptocurrency, and that cryptocurrency ends up in our crypto wallets. Yes, we got fat stacks of the bitcoins, and we aim to stack them even higher to make the stacks as fat as Carl's mama ass. You can quote me on that, sir. And of course, we are lemonized over on DLive. You can give us lemons to go with the fried chicken and watermelons. Of course, lemon chicken is a bit of a white meal, I am told. I have tried making it myself, and it is quite delicious. But you can give us lemons, you can give us diamonds, ice creams, ninja genies, ninjets, and all of the other related DLive tokens, and already we have Slog with the perennial 14 lemons donating. He's broken the ice, he's blasted through the ice, 14 every stream, our man Slog. And thank you for that, sir. And as you say in the land of frozen lakes, Kitos Citruvista. And of course, you can always donate through DLive. Now, on DLive, you can give us either library tokens, which are Odyssey. On Odyssey, you can give us library tokens, which are Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency, or you can actually give us a cash tip in, for now, American dollars, but who knows, maybe we'll see a donation in some other fiat currency tonight. But yeah, that's actually cash money over on Odyssey. And those would be the direct ways to donate to Countercurrents, Entropy, Cash App, DLive, Odyssey, MoonPay, and also you have the indirect way of giving to Countercurrents, and that is purchasing the fine products of our sponsor, Alaska Chaga. Sniff. Slurp. I actually have it as stage directions in my shill script to sniff and slurp the delicious Alaska Chaga tea. It's got, not electrolytes, the other thing. Antioxidants, and it's good for your digestion. It's good for your sleep schedule, for your circadian rhythm. They harvest it off of the mulberry trees over in Alaska, although I hear it also grows in Russia and Finland and similar Nordic climates. So, you know, we might even see some European distribution in the near future, or so I've been told by sparrows wishing to remain anonymous. But for the time being, purchase Alaska Chaga. It's not only a good product, but you're also helping the cause. Every time you purchase Alaska Chaga, NFT or any of its other associated products, not limited to Chaga tea. Of course, they also got Chaga soap, and it really goes in deep with the dead skin tissue. It's sort of like a half soap, half loofah. I don't know how they do it, but it is an amazing thing they've done with the Chaga soap. And I guess we can get into it, Carl. So I gotta let's start with this. What have you been up to since last time you were on the writer's block?
Not a whole lot. I mean, just in terms of like, I've been observing with great trepidation what's, you know, happening in the crypto markets, but in particular with like Ethereum right now, because there's a merge happening where they're trying to convert Ethereum from a proof of work coin into a proof of stake coin. And that's, it's caused Ethereum to pump quite a bit, and it's kind of making me anxious because, I'm concerned that we're going to see some pushback against Bitcoin following this transition, because I'm afraid that we're going to see the Ethereum advocates attacking Bitcoin on the basis that it's, dirty, you know, in terms of, wasteful in its energy use. And before, Ethereum advocates couldn't really claim that, you know, they couldn't really attack Bitcoin on that basis because Ethereum also used proof of work. But when they make the transition, they're probably going to come out swinging against Bitcoin. So we'll see how that goes. I get the feeling, though, that the powers that be have already decided that Bitcoin is going to stick around because BlackRock has announced recently that they've created a Bitcoin custodial trust for high net worth individuals and institutions that want to invest in Bitcoin. So I don't think BlackRock would have done that if they had some sort of inside knowledge or awareness of Western governments deciding to crack down on Bitcoin. So I'm not too worried about that, but I am just a little bit worried about Ethereum and just sort of its advocates kind of going hog wild against Bitcoin. But other than that, the way I'm looking at it right now is I'm looking at the economy on the presumption that we've already seen the bottom. And the reason I think that is because I think that there's just, I think that we're heading into the midterms with Biden in November.
You mean bottom of the recession in general or bottom of the crypto market?
Both. I think that there's a real possibility we've already seen the bottom because despite all of the terrible data that we're seeing coming out in terms of like, you know, high energy prices and stuff like that, I think that most of that's been priced in. And I think that when things get bad this winter, particularly in Europe, I think that the only answer to that, barring like, you know, the governments are going to have to kind of head off civil unrest. And I think that they really, you know, obviously the way they've been doing it in terms of propaganda is they've been portraying themselves as, left wing and leftist in the sense that they're, you know, the right doesn't care about the poor and the working class. And meanwhile, these guys who are importing millions of immigrants to compete with the working class, they do care. And, when energy prices go up and people start to, not have enough money to pay for rent and food, it's especially in Europe, I think that they're going to have to print. You know, they're just going to have to go bonkers with the printer. And I think it's going to be similar to what's happening to it in Argentina right now. I just saw that Argentina's interest rate, their interest rate right now, their official interest rate in Argentina is like 69%. And the inflation rate is like 74% or something like that. Now, Argentina has a history of having high inflation rate, you know, but I think we're going to start seeing that kind of thing in Europe and eventually in the U.S. But I think that in terms of like just nominal prices of assets, I think we might have already seen the bottom, because I think that we're going to have so much inflation that the Fed and other central banks are just going to try to they're just going to give up on trying to rein in inflation. It's kind of gotten to the point where I don't think they're going to be able to contain it for much longer. But yeah, that's what I'm thinking right now.
So that's good to know that I guess we've seen the worst of it. I did see oil prices stabilizing the other day. They had reached pre-war levels, so levels that they were before the war in Ukraine. So that's good news. I recently refilled my tank of gas on my car, and I was surprised to learn that this was we were at pre-war gas prices here in Macedonia. I guess things will stabilize over the long term.
It's funny, gasoline and just commodities generally, you know, they react very quickly to news of bad, you know, like if unemployment rate goes up, or if there's like bad economic news, the price of oil falls, you know. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but like, you know, bad news is kind of good news in a roundabout way, because you will get lower energy prices when people anticipate a recession. So,
yeah, I mean, I was lurking around Twitter, and I saw Nassim Taleb saying the stuff like, you know, I've never seen a shortage not followed by a glut, because, you know, it's basic supply and demand. Yeah. Oil prices spiking, oil producers looking to make money drive the price of oil down. Now, you got goods which are less elastic, like, for example, natural gas, because it's more difficult to transport than oil. But natural gas, too, will react. So I'm really not worried about winter in Europe, if I'm being completely honest. By the time winter rolls around, there will be substitutes for Russian energy, specifically for the heating of the homes. Industry might actually need to take a haircut. But again, this is Europe. Governments here are a little more vigorous about intervening in the economy, and they're really not ashamed to outright nationalize firms specifically to save them. We have history here of the French government, for example, nationalizing one of the auto manufacturers. I forget which one. Might have been Renault. Just to cleanse it of debt, and then reprivatizing it once it liquidated its debt. And this, at the time I heard of it, I read very heavily, because I was a libertarian at the time, but my father, you know, he's a little smarter, he's a little wiser maybe, you know, he said, no, this was the right thing, because now France retains its auto manufacturer industry rather than lose it. Right. Why? Because the government was willing to eat the debt, to eat the loss, and save Renault. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm bullish, but I'm not running for the hills with regard to Europe's economy. I'm going to, you know, I don't think we're going to hit Argentina levels, for one very simple reason. I mean, I'm not markets guy, but I do understand demographics. Europe is composed for the time being of white people. Argentina, it's a little touch and go when it comes to white people. So it's a little touch and go on the economy.
Yeah. So, well, Argentina has been, you know, on the decline for like a long time now, you know, compared to Europe. But yeah, I think I remember reading somewhere recently that I think Germany, I think it was Germany, they said that they were going to either reopen or just halt the closing of a nuclear power plant that they were planning on closing. And so I think that at least the Germans, the leadership there is kind of setting aside their green bullshit for a minute to make some room for extra energy, you know, production. But I think, you know, in terms of like, you know, I think most people listening are aware that nuclear is probably the best thing we have available to us, just, you know, for a number of reasons. But it's just very, nuclear is very predictable. It's also very, it doesn't take up a lot of space. You know, like you look at like natural gas, solar, biomass, and you know, all these other renewable like wind and stuff, those things take up enormous amount of space to produce an equivalent amount of energy to what is produced in a very tiny space with nuclear. And so I still think nuclear is our best bet. And we really, you know, if we had had a good nuclear policy for the last 40 years or so, we really wouldn't even be having these discussions today, because we would have so many nuclear power plants that we, you know, just it wouldn't be, we wouldn't have to be worried about having tons of batteries and you know, peaker plants with natural gas and stuff like that. But unfortunately, you know, the green guys in the 60s and 70s spread this propaganda against nuclear, and it captured the minds of the masses. And thankfully, that guy Oliver Stone, you know, who makes the documentaries, he's releasing a new documentary soon. The title of the documentary is Nuclear, and it's great because you know, I'm happy because it means that, you know, his audience, who are mostly left wingers, will watch this, and hopefully many of them will have their minds changed. And so, you know, seeing a sort of a prominent left winger trying to sort of steer the left into liking nuclear again is a great thing. I mean, that's going to be really helpful for the West.
You know, I remember last year, a lot of people were saying, oh, nuclear is good, nuclear is this, nuclear is that. I remain a nuclear skeptic, because see, the problem is nuclear sounds great until you have a Fukushima.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking about, I live in Macedonia, right? I'm Macedonian. So I'm thinking, how could this shit go wrong? Why Macedonia doesn't have a nuclear power plant? Reason number one, this is an earthquake prone environment. Right? We got earthquakes here. So do the Japanese. In fact, Fukushima was caused by an earthquake. And the Armenians have one big nuclear plant over in Armenia, again, lying straight across a fault line. So you're basically taking your life in your hands with this thing. We're seeing right now in Ukraine, there is a battle raging near the Zaporizhia power plant. And the Russians have apparently put artillery pieces near the plant and are shelling the Ukrainians from there. And you got basically counter battery operations by the Ukrainians, and the plant is in danger. Mm-hmm. There's been also rumors that the plant is mined, and apparently the local Russian commander has threatened to detonate the mines. This is unconfirmed, so just take it with a grain of salt. Then you have the problems that France is facing, really, which is there's a drought, so there's not enough water to cool the plants.
Keep it cool. Yeah.
And so they've shut them down and are actually importing energy from Germany right now. You know, Germany, which is supposed to be struggling with energy.
Yeah.
And and of course, the last bit is uranium, right? You still need uranium, and not all countries have their own uranium sources. So you're still basically in a hawk to foreign interests, just as you would be with oil. Now, large countries like America, Canada, France even can maybe source their own uranium, but you think about Germany, you know, what's Germany's biggest problem since there is a Germany? It's raw materials for its industrial base, for its energy needs, come from outside of Germany.
Yeah. Right?
This would not change if Germany were to go nuclear. There are no uranium mines that I know of within German territory. And even if they were, I doubt they would be able to feed that massive industrial juggernaut they have over there.
Yeah.
So basically there would be no energy independence for Germany if it went nuclear. Could be one for America. But America can also have energy independence just on the force of its own fossil fuels.
Yeah. Well, I think Germany actually has quite a lot of untapped natural gas underground that they just have, you know, for their own reasons, they've just decided not to exploit it. But it would be interesting to see, you know, if a future German government ever decides to, you know, tap into that and get it. But I agree with you that nuclear is, I think that's the fact that it's so unsafe is sort of one of the side effects of the fact that it has been so heavily regulated over the last, you know, 40, 50 years. Is just there haven't been that many iterations or variations on the design of nuclear power plants. And it's only been kind of recently that people have been starting to imagine how you could build a nuclear power plant in a safer way. And, interestingly enough, I think that, France is the one country that has really been at the forefront of figuring out ways to make nuclear plants easier to build and safer. And they've come up with new designs. And, also, Bill Gates has been investing in these startups that supposedly are working on making miniature nuclear plants that are like, the size of a bedroom or something. But, I generally agree, like you need to have, basically nuclear power is really only, it's ideal for nations that are mostly sort of high IQ, like you can, and also don't have many natural disasters. So, but yeah, I mean, I think in terms of like what we're looking at now with energy production, I think, honestly, I think solar is fantastic. And I know a lot of people are skeptical of solar, but when you look at what's possible with solar in terms of like for people living in rural areas, especially, it's really going to be a game changer because the price of solar panels just has not stopped declining. And it's gotten to the point now where solar panels are so amazingly cheap versus where they were, just 5 years ago, even that it makes total sense if you're building a home in this, at least the southern part of the U.S. To go ahead and just include solar in as part of the build, because over time it pays for itself. I think the solar panels pay, they ended up paying for themselves after like 6 years, which is really not that long. I mean, when you think about it, after 6 years, if you're living in the same house, 100% of your electricity is essentially free at that point.
Yeah, but that's the thing about solar panels is I remember 20 years ago, my father wanted to install solar panels on our roof, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time, they were so inefficient that he estimated that they would pay for themselves after 20 years,
Yeah.
Right now, we would be, except, of course, if we upgraded, but that would always increase the cost of things, right? So this is all really very recent developments in technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And with solar panels,
A lot of people. That's what a lot of people on the right, I think, are just sort of. They're skeptical of certain technologies like this because I think that they're thinking of them in terms of how they were 10, 20 years ago, and they're constantly improving. Like every year. Batteries and solar panels fall in price, 10-15%, and that compounds over time. But yeah, go ahead and finish your thought. What were you saying?
Anyways, yeah, my point is, and people are pointing out in the chat that solar panels are good for local needs, not viable for industry. That might change in the future, right? But for the time being, even if, for example, we could have all the civilian consumption of electricity outsourced to solar. Right, that's good. It frees up everything else for industry and stuff like that. But my primary objection to solar energy would be environmental, and specifically, they take up a lot of space. Right, they are, and they're ugly to look at. Let's not beat around the bush. I'm not an environmentalist like carbon shit and stuff like that. I'm a conservationist. I think that people, men, governments. Have a duty to conserve the environment for our posterity, right? A future for white children should include nature. It should include forests. It should include meadows as we have them. Or however much possible, we should minimize our impact on our environment. I'm not saying be a moron and ignore science like the carbon footprint people. No, I'm saying... Put a little in regulation, and for this reason, I tend towards fossil fuels and nuclear as the most viable sources of energy, precisely because they're not eyesores, precisely because they do not take up vast tracts of land we could devote to something else, like I don't know, agriculture. We need to feed ourselves, after all, and of course, nature preserves. And, you know, again, from a practical standpoint, what if you don't have flat ground? Because here in Macedonia, 75% of the country is mountains and hills, where we go, and the rest we use for agriculture and living, right? Mm-hmm. So where are we going to put these solar panels? We can put them on top of buildings, but...
I totally understand what you're saying. I think, solar, it's kind of cringe when people will put solar on like a giant field that you know could have been utilized for something like farm animals or park or something like that. I think solar makes sense if you're going to put the panels over top of like parking lots. Like if you know, I'm sure you've been to the U.S., so you know you've seen a huge chunk of the U.S. is paved.
I hate transatlantic flying. I hate long flights in general. Now maybe if we could, you can put me on a slow boat to America, but airplanes, no, not happening.
Yeah, it's kind of cramped when you're sitting in a capsule for 8 hours. But
I would probably go insane. Right?
Yeah,
maybe that's what happened to the 9/11 guys.
Right. I think I like solar for certain applications. I like I think for cities. And for towns, solar doesn't make sense because, you know, you've got that compact, everybody's living on top of each other. So it makes more sense to explore, different methods of production of energy. But, I think solar it's awesome for if you want to not be reliant on the government. And I view solar as kind of like it's sort of an ideal thing for libertarians and even the dissident right. If you own land like a farm or whatever, and you don't want to be vulnerable to government cutting off your electricity, solar is definitely the way to go. And it'll only get better from here. But it's funny. You'll read these articles online about somebody figured out a way to make solar panels, 20% more efficient or whatever. And it's like if you look at the history of solar panels, they used to be awful. Like they used to really produce a lot less energy than they do now. And I think what's happened is they've gotten to the point now where they have reached a degree of efficiency that it's not even necessary to go beyond that. Like, while it's probably scientifically possible to make solar panels more efficient using like perscovites and rare earth metals and things, it's not worth it because it's like, why make them 20% more efficient when you can just go out and buy 20% more solar panels as they exist now?
That's a problem you have if you have an abundance of land. I know you are thinking about this problem in an American context, and that is good, but I keep coming back to the European context. Mm-hmm. And our chief problem here on this continent is that we do not have enough space, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe in Eastern Europe, this is less of a problem. So let's say a country like, Poland or Romania or even the Ukraine after the war is over could actually have a viable solar panel sector because there are vast stretches of open land. But in Western Europe, simply not happening, especially not in a place that is densely populated as Germany or the United Kingdom. Well, in the United Kingdom, England is insanely densely populated, whereas the outlying countries are just less densely populated, I guess. However, Carl, and we have been chin wagging for about half an hour. I invited you to discuss unlimited power, by which I mean. You may have stumbled onto a way to generate infinite electricity, or so at least you told me. I immediately assumed that you were Emperor Palpatine from Star Wars seeking unlimited power. That's
that would be nice, but
that would be very nice. We could end all of our problems just by using the dark side.
You could just help generate electricity from hate. I was actually, it's funny, I was joking with my friend the other day, he asked me like, how do you stay so thin despite what you eat? And I said, well, I probably expend 2,000 calories a day just hating.
Well, I would try that, but I have a problem. I stress eat. So,
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think yeah, what geothermal is really cool. Like I mean, yeah, I used to really not think too much about geothermal because I was always under the impression that it was like something that was sort of isolated to certain weird areas of the earth, like Iceland and places like that. But it's and also I think there's a lot of geothermal in like Hawaii, places with volcanoes. But you know, what's cool now is that there's new technology out now, this drilling technology actually, and people are coming up with new ways to drill. Currently, the way they drill to get geothermal is they use the same drill heads that they use to drill for oil and natural gas, and those drill heads are they have diamond bits, and the way they're designed, they don't really last very long. Like, that you basically have to swap out the drill heads because they'll wear down as they go through the rock. But I saw there's a few companies now that are currently competing to come out with new drilling heads that actually use plasma. And so that what they do is they pump gas down there and ignite it. And it basically creates this super hot plasma and causes the rock to essentially vaporize, and then they can suck the vaporized rock up and out. And this means that the drill head doesn't need to be swapped out all the time. Now, the process is a little bit slower than regular drilling, but the advantage is that it's a lot cheaper. And so that means that in theory, as the price of drilling goes down, we could see these geothermal plants become much more cost competitive with other forms of energy production. And the other advantages too is that right now we have pretty much every major drilling expert. Like if you know anything about drilling, if you're like a engineer or whatever, you're probably going to be working in the oil and gas sector, right? Because that's where it's at. And what my thinking is that over the next 10 years, as oil and as the fracking field kind of winds down, I think that those guys are going to move over to geothermal, and that's going to cause the price of drilling to decline even further. And so we'll see the same equipment being used to drill down into bedrock. Now, once you get down, like I think it's like 1.5 miles. Of course, a lot of this depends on where you are on the Earth's surface. But once you get down to a certain level of bedrock, the rock itself contains a bunch of new radioactive isotopes that are constantly emitting radiation, and that radiation basically it's like a sort of a natural a nuclear power plant down there, and it's heating up the rock. About a mile or two below the surface in the bedrock, that rock is scorching hot, like it's 300 degrees Celsius. And the idea is that you drill down to it and you create a loop, and this is all possible with, modern technology. This isn't like some theoretical thing. The only issue is that it's cost prohibitive. But once you create a loop, you can pump water down one end of it, and then when the water comes out the other end, it's superheated, and then you send that water into a basically the loop itself is contained. It's closed, so the water never leaves the loop, when it comes out the other end hot, it is passed over a radiator type device that transfers that heat to another loop, a second loop. And the second loop contains a refrigerant chemical. And so that's closed loop also. And so that refrigerant chemical, when it's in contact with the super hot pipe, it turns into gas and it spins a turbine. And so there's that turbine can generate a large amount of electricity essentially continuously. This process never stops. And these geothermal plants can last, 30, 40 years without ever needing to be serviced, because they're just, there's no corrosion going on or anything like that. It's just, constant cycle and heat being brought up. And of course, the ground never cools off from this, because it's sort of like, it's sort of like dipping a hair into a swimming pool. It doesn't matter how cold your hair is, it's not going to cause the swimming pool to cool down. So it's really sort of a limitless way to get energy. Now, it's not, as far as I understand it, it's not necessarily going to be enough energy for some like major industrial applications, like, for instance, a giant factory or desalination of seawater. For those types of things that require huge amounts of energy, you'd probably prefer to have nuclear power plants. But for pretty much every civilian application, geothermal is just awesome because it lasts a super long time. It's super safe, and it doesn't require maintenance, really. So yeah, that's something that's really exciting to me. And I think that, if somebody listening to this is kind of young and they're interested in going into some sort of an engineering field, I would recommend looking at drilling generally. I think drilling, you're just not going to run out of work as an engineer who knows about drilling.
Well, once you learn how to drill, you never really run out of opportunities to do so. We are pro drilling. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be a classy show. We are pro drilling here at the Writer's Block, even though we have the sense of humor of 12-year-old children. Now, of course, this probably comes with risks we haven't even begun to anticipate, and we are going to discuss them. We are going to talk about those risks, but first, I got to ask you, Carl. Have you heard of the nuclear core hypothesis?
The nuclear core hypothesis, is this referring to the Earth?
Or... Indeed.
Okay.
There is a hypothesis out there, so I guess you haven't heard of it. And the guy who forwarded it, I think he's a little touched in the head, but most geniuses are. I think he may have been on JF at one point, but I'm not sure. I've known about this hypothesis for a very long time, and it's actually part of my own, let's call it an answer to the Fermi paradox. He posits that due to circumstances we do not fully understand, right? And due to essentially uranium sinking to the core of the Earth as a heavier element than other naturally occurring elements, right? What's going on at the core of the Earth is not the classic thing you've seen in school, but so it's not the classic model is you have the inner core, which is solid ferronickel, iron and nickel core, and around it you have the outer core, which is liquid iron and nickel, and it spins around, and above that you have magma, which is molten rock, and above that you have the thin crust on which we live and will eventually crack, and we will fall into the magma and all die. But looking forward to that happy day some other time. This guy says, well, it's like that, but at the core, right, under the ferro-nickelous core is a uranium core, which is undergoing fissile reactions, which is what causes the volcanic activity. So the reason why we have magma, why we have the outer molten ferro-nickelous core and seismic and volcanic activity here on Earth is precisely because there is a massive natural nuclear reactor at the center of the Earth.
Right? Yeah.
And it's pumping energy out into the Earth's magma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And causing all of these reactions.
That sounds entirely plausible to me. I don't see why that wouldn't be the case.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also the reason behind seismic activity, because Continental plates float on top of molten magma. If it were solid, they would not float, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the control group for this, and this is where it gets interesting, because the planet Venus is almost the exact same size as Earth. It's a little smaller, but yeah, we're talking very small difference between Venus and Earth in size. And we know that Venus had at one point both seismic and volcanic activity, and not anymore, right?
Mm.
So he looks at Venus and says, this is a place where the nuclear reaction just went out.
Right? Yeah.
For whatever reason, there was not enough fissile material and seismic and volcanic activity.
Well, the same exact thing happened to Mars too, I guess. Because as far as I know, I don't think Mars...
Or Mars never really had a nuclear core to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I think you need some kind of seismic activity and molten core, I think, in order to have a magnetosphere around your planet. And so, if you don't have that sort of, it's like a flow. It's like, I don't know if people have ever.
It's basic watched. Physics. Spinning metal causes a magnetic field.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because it's like. I'm trying to think of the way to describe it, but like if you've ever like boiled a pot of water on the stove and you've looked at how the steam moves, the steam doesn't just go straight up out of the pot. It actually kind of rotates. So it'll come out of the middle and then it'll fall back down. It'll kind of rotate out. And that's basically how it works inside of the sun and presumably inside of the Earth too, is that you have sort of this, the magma gets superheated near the core and it flows upward toward the surface, and then it'll encounter the surface and then kind of curve back around and rotate back down toward the core. And so you get these sort of loops of movement, and those loops are the things that create the magnetosphere. And so but yeah, if it weren't for the magnetosphere, there would not be life, because you need the magnetosphere to basically protect the surface of the Earth from all sorts of radiation. Like there's obviously the sun is constantly spitting out, radiation. And also we have radiation from other stars that are undergoing, cosmic,
right.
Yeah, supernovas and things like that. And so, if the magnetosphere ever goes away, it becomes a big problem. And I think that I'm pretty sure that one of the major global extinction events, it might have been the Precambrian extinction event, one of those extinction events, was scientists think it might have been precipitated by the Earth's magnetic field just sort of shutting off for like a few million years. And when it sort of rebooted and came back online, that's when we had this giant explosion of species and life. And so the idea was that the extinction might have been caused by the loss of the magnetosphere.
Yeah, because it was so much more dramatic than, for example,
Jurassic, or maybe
Cretaceous extinction event. I'm sorry, I have it in an encyclopedia around here, but it's paper, and I would actually have to look for that book right now, and I cannot get up. But yeah, I mean, it's the one that done in the trilobites. So unlike the Cretaceous extinction event, it took out a vast percentage of life on Earth. Just vast, vast, vast percentage. The Cretaceous extinction event was very mild by comparison.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you can imagine anything that would take out the trilobites, which are like basically cockroaches. I mean, that must have been absolutely cataclysmic. I think maybe the only thing that survived would have been like bacteria and stuff like that.
No, complex life forms did survive it, although it was a little touch and go for a couple of million years there, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need the magnetosphere, and it's precisely this. I think we discussed it last time you were on the show, right? Why I don't believe in Mars colonization, because Mars does not have a magnetosphere.
Yeah.
And we mean you cannot, we are, whether we like it or not, we are evolved for this environment where we are protected from cosmic radiation and solar radiation by the Earth's magnetosphere. And furthermore, we are evolved for this particular gravity. Now, Mars has less than half of the Earth's gravity. If we are not exposed to this particular gravity, we die of osteoporosis alone.
Yeah. Right?
And yeah, all sorts of other things. Like you look at astronauts who've spent a long time in space, their bodies are completely, you know, just dissolved by the experience. And right, you don't become an astronaut for your health.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I don't know if you've heard this, but astronauts who spend a long time in space, they say that when they're up there, and I think actually the Apollo guys who walked on the moon said the same thing, that when they were up there and they closed their eyes, while their eyes were closed, they would see flashes of light every once in a while. And the theory was that the reason these astronauts are seeing these lights is because that's gamma rays and other forms of high power radiation that's hitting their retinas while their eyes are closed. So it's causing their retinas to actually register flashes of light. And so you can imagine if you have these high power radiation waves that are constantly hitting your body from all angles, I mean, over time, that's going to liquefy your DNA. I mean, it's sort of like you can imagine your body is like a Jenga tower, and every once in a while, one of the blocks is knocked out. You know,
I don't like the Jenga tower. I'm an analogy because my orthopedist once said it about my spine.
Oh,
but
no,
we are. No, it's nothing serious. I have, you know, the old Weigy disease, spinal compression. You know, it's just from spending a very long time of my long period of my life sitting down, which is apparently not good for you. But yeah, this is actually a very good analogy. Your DNA as a Jenga tower and the radiation just knocking random blocks all over the place. The effects of low gravity, cosmic radiation, solar radiation, everything. And I like it. Reed Johnson in the chat says, that's Mother Nature telling you that you don't belong in space. That's actually...
Yeah,
I mean, but, you know, we're human beings. We don't belong at the bottom of the ocean either. And yet you still have people scuba diving and, you know, the French guy in his Batiscaf going to Marianas Trench. People don't belong in all sorts of weird places, right? And yet we still go there. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe this will not stop expansion to Mars and so in the future. But yeah, we have discussed this. The magnetosphere is very important, and gravity is very important. And what's really important is we have to go back on track. So you were talking, of course, about geothermal energy, Carl, and we have comments here in the chat. Criticism from Trad Dad. He says, 200 plus well geothermal system at building I work, never commissioned because of leaks. And he says clown world in emoji. Would you comment on that?
Oh, he might be talking about like a heat pump system where you have, it's not like a super deep system, and I may be wrong. I don't know, but I'm not sure what he's talking about, but I think that he might be talking about like where you have a shallow geothermal system where your pipe only goes maybe like 6 to 10 feet underground. And it instead of collecting super hot heat at the bedrock level, it's sort of collecting cooler temperatures as the coolant passes through the pipe 10 feet underground, because there's a certain level underground, and I'm not sure what it is, but it's not that far. It's really only like 6 feet or so, where the ground does not change temperature throughout the year. So in the middle of summer and the middle of winter, the ground is the exact same temperature, you know, like 6 feet down. And if you can get tubes down that low and sort of have them cycling a refrigerant down there, you can have a system that will efficiently heat and cool your home during the extremes. So like in the extreme winter time, your heat pump will much more efficiently heat your home, and in the middle of the summer, it'll also more efficiently cool it because it's going down there. But yeah, anytime you have like a long plastic pipe underground, it's going to eventually, you're going to eventually encounter leaks and pressure problems, I guess. The main issue with like a large, like a deep geothermal system, like the one I was describing earlier, where it has to go down like a mile or more, is if you have a seismic event. So if there's like a earthquake or something like that that actually causes the drill hole to shift or to crack, then that would theoretically, cause issues. And of course too, there that's another criticism of this, is that it's sort of similar to like the criticism of fracking, where when you pump a liquid down underground, that either dissolves minerals down there, or it causes some sort of pressure differentials that makes the area more prone to geologic activity. So, like, people who live near fracking sites will often complain of earthquakes and potentially things like that. And it's true, like there's actually some evidence that this causes earthquakes.
I mean, the problem here would be not so much quote unquote earthquakes if we define that as seismic activity, but would be essentially a local shifts of Earth due to, well, like you said, changes of pressure differentials and density of turf because of the water coming in. I mean, water coming in, it would be it we you'd have so many things that could go wrong when you're pumping water into the ground. You're saying you could liquefy the soil, and liquefied soil does not hold weight, especially not the weight of buildings, right? So,
Well,
yeah,
it's
this.
like, it's like having a super thin straw, and it's like going very, very far underground and coming out of ground. Like when you have a tunnel that's very thin, and it, when I say thin, it's real, like realistically, it's going to be like 6 to 8 inches wide, the tube essentially. So it's not like it's not that thin, but it when you're talking about the distance, it has to go down a mile and up a mile, it is very, very thin. And so there's it's kind of it's
I mean,
potentially
again, the pressures you're dealing with here would be very high. I mean, so you even a slight seismic shift like you have, and because I'm guessing this is going to have to be made out of ultra flexible, ultra durable materials. You're gonna not gonna just pump water willy-nilly into the ground.
No,
You're gonna
yeah, like
actually coat the
that's the
tube.
difference. Like so, like with fracking, you're pumping the liquid, directly into the ground, and the liquid is actually sort of entering into all these like little crevices and nooks and crannies, and that's what's forcing the gas up and out the other side, right? With this, you're literally making a pipe, and so you're sending the pipe down there, and so it's like so yeah, ideally, you would not have a leak. It would, like I said, it would be a closed loop, and the liquid would be, stuck in the tube basically.
Well, see, here we come to a problem. So this would be water under a tremendous amount of pressure, otherwise how could it travel a mile and a half, right? And it would also be coming up it at very high temperatures. Like you mentioned, 300 degrees. I assume you mean Celsius.
Yes, Celsius.
Okay, maybe if we go deeper, we can get 500 degrees. That's even more energy. But so you got heat, you got pressure, you got speed, and you have ground which is constantly shifting. Now, even if you're not in an area known for seismic activities, so let's say this is happening in Missouri. No seismic activities in Missouri, I assume. Like, no earthquakes in Missouri, right?
I don't think so. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm asking you a question. I don't know.
I really
so
don't know.
I don't have a seismographic map of North America with me.
Idaho, maybe looks, we could say, yeah. Ohio.
Idaho does have earthquakes, actually. It's part of the Pacific Rim.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, let's call it Ohio, right? Let's say Ohio. Yeah. Nothing interesting ever happens in Ohio, except the countercurrents bash at Columbus.
Right.
I hear that was very fun. But, let's say it's Ohio. You still have minor reverberations all throughout the Earth's crust, which we may not notice at the surface of the ground in Ohio, but underground, a mile underground, a mile and a half underground, things may be a little different. You might actually damage the tube, and high pressure, very, very hot water could just pump spray everywhere. And even if nothing untoward happens, how are you going to repair this tube? I imagine it's going to be under tremendous amounts of stress, and it's going to need constant.
Yeah, I don't think you could repair it. You would have to dig another one, and that would take a long time. So yeah, it's not suited to places with seismic activity. But my question, I'm honestly not sure what a facility like this. How long it would last, because I think that if you manage to get it in an area that's, sort of ideal for this, it might last, 20 to 30 years, maybe about as, I mean, you know, I can imagine it about as long as a nuclear power plant would, but nuclear power plants, I think could potentially even last longer, because I think that they're decommissioned after maybe like 50 years. But, it's funny because like this sort of technology and most, it's just the nature of all these different technologies is that things are constantly improving in various ways. And so it's really, really difficult to, make a really certain guess or estimate as to what's going to be the best thing to invest in now, right? Because, 20, 30 years from now, who knows, there might be some major breakthrough that makes a very simple fusion reactor cheap and easy to make, in which case all of this is just a moot point. But when it comes to today, there's all these different methods of generating energy, and really the thing that everybody can agree on, despite these diversity of ways to make energy, the thing that everybody can agree on is that there's a huge need for energy storage and energy storage. And one of the benefits of oil and gas and petroleum and anything related to fossil fuels is that it is its own storage medium. It's its own battery. You don't need to think about how am I going to store all of this energy. It's in a barrel. there's no thinking necessary involved. And so that's what makes oil and gas and, especially like if you're, if you liquefy gas, and coal and things like that, they're already stored. So the question now is like, how do we store the energy that we're producing that's just simply not being utilized? If you're producing a ton of energy in one part of the world and it's not needed in that part of the world, or it's not needed at that moment in time, how do you shift it from there to another part or another time where people can actually utilize it? And there's so many different battery technologies and there's different types of batteries. And if you study it, it's reminiscent of how what was going on like in the early 20th century with the light bulb, because back when Edison was sort of trying to figure out how to make an ideal light bulb, he had a bunch of people working for him in a warehouse, and they were essentially doing trial and error on different gases and different shapes and different types of filaments and things like that. And they stumbled on the answer, it took them lots and lots of trial and error to figure out the best way to do a light bulb. And I kind of feel like that's the way it's going to be with batteries. I think that we're still kind of stumbling around trying to figure out what the best way to do batteries is, because there's lithium ion batteries, and there's multiple types of lithium ion batteries. In fact, Tesla just recently, like in the last few months, they changed the specific battery chemistry that they were using in their cars. And then there's liquid metal batteries. There's actually sand-based batteries. There's rust batteries, which are an iron air battery. There's pumped. I mean, well, you can pump water up a hill. That's essentially like a battery, and that's actually, funny enough, that's actually probably the best type of battery that there is, really, is pumping water up a hill. But
Yeah.
unfortunately, you can't do that
Yeah, I
everywhere
was
because.
gonna. They do that actually in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway.
Yeah,
Denmark has
because they're able to do it, but like most places, you just can't do it because it's too flat and there's just not a large reservoir of water to do it. And then
Well, you look at. I was looking at because I was preparing for this, and I knew you would have the American perspective, and so I looked at the European perspective. So what's the flattest country in Europe? Well, it's dead heat between Poland and Ukraine, but if you look at it, Ukraine is just lousy with hydroelectric power plants. I didn't know this, but 10% of Ukrainian power needs, both industrial and civilians, are met just by hydroelectric power plants only on the Dnipro or the Dnieper River, which is the biggest river. And they also got smaller ones and bigger ones here in Macedonia. We have a good hydroelectric sector. It's actually some. It could be a source of patriotism for us. I'm surprised a lot. It's not more front and center. I know the French mine patriotism from their nuclear sector. And we mentioned Norway and Sweden, right? So what happens is the Danish apparently generate a bunch of renewable energy from solar and maybe tidal harnesses, I'm not sure. And they store it by transferring the energy to Sweden and Norway, where it's pumped into the accumulated water, into the artificial lakes behind hydroelectric dams, and then released whenever necessary.
That's
So
amazing.
this is basically cooperation between Denmark, Sweden, and Norway has made it possible for the Danes to claim that a certain percentage of they have actually figured a way to store generated solar, wind, and tidal harness energy. Now, like you said, this could be problematic. Oh, if you haven't got hydroelectric capability, right? And yeah, this could be a problem in a place like, well, we mentioned Ohio. Ohio is a pretty flat place, right? But I don't know. Wherever you have rivers, you can develop hydroelectric capability. Now, it comes with problems of its own from a conservation of standpoint. So basically, you're going to have an artificial lake. You're going to have the large reservoir forming behind the dam, and that could disrupt nature. That could disrupt human life as well. I mean, the Chinese, they did. What they did with the Three Gorges Dam was they displaced a large number of people who were living there. Every time you construct a hydroelectric dam, this is just what's going to happen, essentially. And you have seismic risks with these dams as well. If they burst, they endanger people. But it is a very interesting way to solve problems. Do go on about the batteries, though. I'm just having a nerd moment over hydroelectric
Well,
power.
I mean, there's one type of battery that's actually really cool that I had just recently learned about. That's I didn't think about this before, but basically what it is somebody figured out that, well, let me preface this by saying there's an entire industry that is, already in existence that's really good at refrigerating and creating large amounts of liquefied gases, basically. And so, if you ever see like these gigantic tanks that are and all these systems of pipes and stuff around natural gas and things like that, what they do is some of these tanks are actually super insulated, and the system around them is basically designed to turn the gas into a liquid via compression and cooling, right? So they super cold, they make the gas super cold. And somebody figured out that you can actually reverse this process and make it essentially use this existing infrastructure as a battery in itself. So if you have like a bunch of windmills or solar panels or whatever, or even, you know, geothermal, what you could do is you could use that electricity to run essentially a giant refrigerator that freezes air. So it'll take in CO2 or, you know, it's just atmospheric air, and turn it into liquid air and store it in a giant tank. And then hours later in the day, when energy is actually needed, you just simply, you know, twist the little knob on the tank and it releases the liquid, air as a high pressure, gas. And so it's not 100% efficient. Like this whole system round trip is like, I think 60 to 70% efficient, somewhere in there is what they said. But so there's some loss involved, but despite that loss, it's actually a great system. And the reason it's great is because there's no new technology needed here. It's just, like I said, this is 100% existing infrastructure that people are already know how to build and produce and already manufacture anyway. So that's an alternative way of storing energy. And then another one that I've heard of is, and I think they might do this in Denmark too, but they'll create like these giant vats of sand, and the sand is heated up somehow. I'm not sure how they heat the sand, but they do. And so the sand gets up to like 400, 500 degrees Fahrenheit. And then in the evening, the heat is somehow emitted back outwards. And I think that that's even less efficient, but I think the refrigerant, the refrigerated air system is actually holds some promise, because I think that we may see something like that in the future as a grid scale storage solution.
Hmm. That's interesting. Of course, if you're running something at a 60%, but the alternative, you know, you're running it at 60% efficiency, but the alternatives is nothing. So yeah. You take what you can get, aside from pumping water up a hill, which is efficient. Now, we could be just carrying it up in buckets, and that could save some energy on the. I mean, people are going to have to eat anyways. So just take a bunch of the unemployed, have them carry the water up in buckets, and generate energy from that. You know, just they eat anyway. You know, what can I say? We do not have the heart to do what is necessary with such people. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, just my inner Kim Jong-un, because as people in the chat are pointing out,
it's cathartic.
Right. The coat of arms of North Korea has a hydroelectric plant. Yes, indeed, it does. And of course, I'm just thinking all the ways that the subservient slave population could be put to good use. You got to get into this mindset. If you're ever going to become a dictator, you got to start thinking of yourself doing dictator stuff, forcing people to carry water up a hill in buckets.
Fake it till you make it.
Exactly. Now I'm going to gain 150 pounds. And it's a shame, though. I do not have an attractive sister or one as attractive as Kim's sister. But in any case, we have donations. People have been donating to the Bucket Challenge Up a Hill Fund. Oh, here at Countercurrents, we have 20 American dollars from Gadius Maximus. And he asks a question of Carl Thorburn. Carl, have you read Rich's new housing article? What are your thoughts on the market? Should I sell and buy a trailer and hunker down for a few years or what? if you would answer this very serious question from Mr. Maximus.
I am not, I Yes, I did read it. I think I'm generally still kind of, I guess you could call me bullish on real estate still. I don't see a major correction coming. I think that I think that if you look at the major difference between now and like 2008 is that is it is all in the rental numbers. Like if you look at rentals, renting is still hugely expensive, and it's only getting more expensive. And I think that right there is evidence that the housing market is still strong, and it's not going to tank like people want it to. I mean, I would love it if it did, because I think it would hurt people like BlackRock and people who are sitting on a lot of houses. But I just don't see it happening anytime soon. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think you should. I mean, that's just my thinking, is that I wouldn't sell at this point. But I think and the Rich's piece, I don't know if it's been officially published yet, because he sent it to me early, but it's sort of sad, but it's like it's also kind of, it makes you think about sort of the broader social implications of people not being able to afford homes. I feel like that's just going to keep on hitting fertility, and it's kind of strange. It's like our elites. I think our elites, they want fertility to be low. They don't. They definitely don't want anybody having lots of kids. And I think that, I don't. I think that goes for every group. I think that goes for every race, right? Because if they wanted, Africans or some subgroup within the West to be producing lots of kids, you would see less of a emphasis on giving them good jobs, and you would see less of an emphasis on, in particular, like feminism for Black women, right? Like Black women in particular have just been really hit with the feminist thing.
Yeah, but see, this is something that you presume that the races will react differently to the same stimulus, which is feminism. Because blacks are matrilocal, and specifically West African blacks, of which part, I mean, and American blacks are descended from them, Brazilian blacks are descended from West African blacks. They have matrilocal societies in which basically the women live apart from the men and raise the children, whereas the men organize in essentially gangs and only really meet the women for copulation, and the men take care of their sisters' children because they don't really know which children are theirs. So to avoid genetic cuckoldry, to make sure that they only provide for children they're related to genetically, they provide for their children's for their sisters' children, insofar as they
Interesting.
provide at all. This is the basic societal organizational model for Western Africa. And of course you have the situation there because the chief agricultural tool is the hoe, right? It's
Go figure.
the hoes who are digging the fields, right? The hoes with the hoes, whereas in Europe it's colder. The ground is harder. We cultivate different crops, so the main agricultural tool is the plow, which requires a lot of strength. And despite all of the jokes about, women being strong with plow, actually you need a man to plow land. And yes, the woman will be behind him with a backhoe, clearing up any places he may have missed during plowing season. And this has actually led to the two very We're talking about the land influencing people. Men in Europe have been selected for strength, but because we have greater economic value in Europe, we are also a patriarchal society, an explicitly patriarchal society, where men need to rule for white people to have proper fertility and just a healthy society in general. Whereas, I mean, the West Africans are not matriarchal. They're still, men in charge of that place, but they're matrilocal. children are raised by women. Economic product is produced by women. It's a far more woman-centric society which West Africans have. And if you look at American blacks, the society is incredibly woman-centered, whereas the men are most of the time off killing each other or you know, trying to steal sneakers or...
playing basketball. You
know, exactly, playing basketball, which is essentially a proxy for war and often degenerates into violence. So I would push back on that. I would say that blacks are more resilient to feminism because their ancestral society is more feminist anyways.
Interesting.
I would say that the whole strong, independent woman hasn't depressed black fertility because it has. But I will say that the rate of depressing the black fertility is lesser than the rate by which feminism depresses white fertility. And of course, the fertility rates were never equal to begin with. Right.
Right.
The blacks have always had a higher fertility rates than the whites.
Yeah.
And that's really what's the thing here. When I hear, oh, blacks have suffered from feminism or feminism was inflicted on blacks. No, it's their ancestral environment. It's what they're selected for. It's in their genes. This is why black men are so sniveling with women. If you actually observe blacks when they don't think white men are watching, right, they're very servile to their women. They're essentially dominated by them. This is a problem for blacks. And, you know, no matter how much we can say, oh, white shit-lip cucks, I don't think that there is that degree of sniveling obedience for white women among white men. If there is, then we're genuinely and truly fucked as a race.
Yeah. I never really thought about it that way. And of course, I've never studied, African social organization, I think I've seen memes and things that sort of hinted that black women were, sort of the dominant or decision-making group in certain tribes or whatever. But I think that, in America anyway, that might come out as like the sort of Beyonce girl boss attitude thing that black women seem to have. You know, it's very, very rare to find a black woman that's, submissive, I guess, you know, is it to men? That's super rare. I mean, you almost never see it. It does make sense. So. Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, like, see, what's interesting is I think that it's only been 1 year, you know, it's only been in the last year or so that the American population has started to turn over and started to decline. And so, I don't know if it's a giant coincidence or not that the Supreme Court, ended the federal restriction, or excuse me, the federal allowance of abortion. But it seems to me that we will be coming up on a point where home builders are going to overplay their hand, like they, you know, they always do. So there will eventually come a point, at some point, probably within the next maybe 5 years, I guess, that we'll see a real housing crash. But I don't think it's anytime soon. I don't think it's going to be like in the next year or two, at least. We got a ways to go, I think.
There is I would say, built on the assumption that at some point these houses are going to have to be liquidated and put on the market, right? Which I am not ready to believe. I'm not ready because, I mean, BlackRock, at this point, I don't think these funds like BlackRock and Vanguard are subject to economic rules because they can just be bailed out ad infinitum by the central banks, by the government, by transgovernmental organizations, right? We may even see the World Economic Forum take a more active role, the World Bank, all of these globalist institutions take an active role in propping up BlackRock and underwriting its losses in the market. And I say this because we have a money laundering problem here in Macedonia with regard to construction. And housing prices are very high, right? Precisely because of all the drug money going into construction. Right? And the drug bosses, they just don't liquidate their property holdings. So there's a bunch of empty apartments. Demand is very high, but these guys just don't liquidate them, right? Mm. Because they don't have to, because this is free money for them.
Right? Yeah.
Or they liquidate them at much lower rates than someone who had built an apartment with the intention of selling or renting it. So understand, when you have basically, in this case, drug, or in the case of BlackRock and Vanguard, the Federal Reserve, the globalist institutions, the governments, just pumping new money into the system and underwriting losses, do not expect BlackRock to liquidate it or similar actors to liquidate its housing stock insofar as they can keep absorbing these losses, and especially if the goal is not to turn a profit from holding and selling houses, but to eradicate home ownership and breed this renter mindset into the population, essentially force the entire population to be renters. I think we can safely agree, you and I, Carl. I know you're not a full schizo like some of our friends are, but I think we agree that the end goal of our elite, of the ruling class, is not to make money, but to radically change society for the worst. So I think we should take our economic or purely economic analysis with a caveat that maybe they are willing to lose money, a lot of money, if it gets them further to their goal of absolute total control, the unlimited power we were talking about in the beginning, of course, but of a different kind.
Yeah. Yeah. The Agenda 2030 type thing. It's, I think, if you think about like what would happen if there were a housing crash at this stage of the game, you know, housing is so huge as a percentage of the total economy, both in Europe and the U.S., that it'd be like the money flowing out of housing would have to go somewhere else. You know, it would be like a pinata exploding, right? And all that money, where would it go? It would cause an enormous inflation in the rest of the economy. I think that. What we need to be looking at, if you want to have sort of an idea of where housing is going, is you should be looking at what's called housing starts, which is just sort of the metric used to determine how many new homes are being built. And as far as I can tell, I think, you know, of course, you know, very recently, housing starts have been declining, at least in the U.S., because of this fear of a crash coming. But I think that in general, you know, thousands and thousands of homes or more homes have been built just in the last 2 years than in the last 7 years or so. So it's like it's kind of been recently, like in the last couple of years, that home building has really exploded and taken off in America, at least. And the preceding 6 or 7 years before that, home builders were wary and afraid to build a lot of homes. But I think now that they know that BlackRock is buying, they'll be less fearful of expanding supply. But you know, if it's only one corporation that's buying, then they can theoretically just keep on buying and not ever selling. But hopefully there we will sort of hit a tipping point where people holding on to homes and real estate sort of become collectively aware of the possibility that this may not be the best store of value anymore. And I think that'll eventually hit. And when it does, there will be a major pullback in prices. But I just don't think it's going to be any time in the next at least in the next year, probably, just because of just the nature of the you know, supply and demand as it exists now.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's interesting to see. But you know, we should always remember our economic thinking should be augmented by. I think this is a major mistake that libertarians make and a lot of other people make, is they assume always that people make economic moves for economic motivations. I've observed, I think the first red pill you get on economics is observing a small business owner, right? Once you've got a little bit of business and work experience yourself, you observe this person and you realize that they're essentially expending more effort, more labor, more stress, right? And they're also the boss or the responsible for everything, and making less money than they would working for someone else, right?
Right, right.
And when you ask them, why are you doing this? And you actually make them fess up to the fact that they're making less money and working more than they would in a big company. And the answer is usually something along the lines of, I am my own boss here.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
In my experience, right, and this is the first time people, this is usually the first experience people have with a non-economically motivated economic move. Because what a small business owner really wants is, I guess, not so much more money, but more freedom, right?
Yes.
And this is actually very valuable, and more valuable than money to a lot of people. I know it is to me. I took a massive, massive income hit a couple of years ago just because I felt trapped in my previous job.
Right.
And in hindsight, I should have made that decision 6 years earlier. My income has stabilized, and I am indeed free right now to set my own hours, to set my own activities, really.
That's a great feeling. And yeah, I know what that's like. I mean, my brother, he runs his own business and I help him with it. And it's, he doesn't, you know, it's not like he's making a huge amount of money. I mean, he's doing very good, but, and despite the business continually growing for the last several years, it's not like he's, you know, living the high life, because he has to work insane hours. And, you know, there's still, you know, a huge amount of work to be done, but at the same time, there's something, it's just far more gratifying and far more, I guess, self-affirming or something like that, to know that when you're working, you're actually working for yourself and not for somebody else. especially somebody that, you know, if they find out your political views, they can just instantly and easily dispense with you.
Right. I mean, the primary motivating sin of entrepreneurship is pride, not greed.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed at, in the entire history of economics, that John Maynard Keynes is the only one who understood this. And yeah. You really start thinking, oh, those libertarian Austrian guys, they hate this guy, but he's the only one who actually understands what's going on in the head of a business owner.
Right. And this is something interesting that I just want to kind of mention in passing. And we might even be able to talk about this another time in the future, because it's an idea that I want to expand on a little bit. But it's the idea of the weekend and, you know, where it came from, because you know, people oftentimes will say that, you know, we get 2 days off, Saturday and Sunday, and the reason we get those days off is because of that's what Henry Ford, or that's what, you know, some socialist or Marxist came up with, you know, right after the Industrial Revolution. But, you know, and then also I'll see Marxists and communists on Twitter and on other social media arguing that, you know, in their ideal society, people would only be working 4 days a week versus, you know, five, and that they would be working far fewer hours, and everybody would have a job, and employment would always be 100%. And it kind of got me thinking. It's like, well, you know, theoretically, the government could pass a law, tomorrow saying, okay, you're not allowed to work more than 4 days a week, 8 hours a day. And in that situation, businesses would be forced to hire more people in order to fill the necessary hours to keep the business going. And if somebody wanted overtime, they couldn't get it. And so it's interesting because when you think about it, a weekend or however much time you take off every week, that's in and of itself a type of economic transaction, because you're sacrificing some potential money for free time to spend with your family and whatever. And so I think that's something that libertarians don't really account for and don't really think too deeply about, is what it means to take time off and how that differs between individuals, because some people are totally fine working on the weekends. They have no problem sacrificing hours and working overtime, but other people really highly value their free time. And so this idea that money is consistently valuable between different people is kind of nonsense, because there's many very intelligent people that just simply don't value money that much. They would rather have free time. So it's complex, and libertarians aren't really taking that into account.
It's actually so complex, but the problem is, right, it does not fit into neat materialist models of the world, because you'd how do I put this? Then you'd have to acknowledge human biodiversity. You have to ask yourself, why are people different? Can we account for these differences? And then the answer comes, yes, there are differences in IQ. There's differences in temperament. There's different, and they map across cultures and races and nations and ethnicities, right? So basically, when you look at the work ethic of white people, you look at the work ethic of black people, you find a glaring difference. Hell, you look at the different work ethics of French and Germans, who are genetically very similar, right? You see a very big difference. And one thing I admire about the Germans specifically is that they have very strong walls between business time and pleasure time. When they work, they work. Yeah. But very few Germans actually value their free time very highly. That's because they don't slack off at work. Right? They have this luxury, whereas I've heard criticisms essentially that people who are not Germans, for example, you have this was from the 2010 era where everyone was making fun of Greeks for being lazy, right? Yeah. Because if Greece went bankrupt, someone came up with a chart that, well, actually, Greeks work the most hours of any Europeans, whereas Germans, on average, are in the lower half, right?
Right.
But then someone pointed out that basically, Greeks work longer hours, but they slack off a lot more than Germans, whereas Germans are just glued. They keep their nose to the grindstone for the fewer hours that they actually work. So German work ethic isn't so much being obsessed with work, but putting everything which is not work out of your head during work hours, which is very efficient.
Yeah, I think, this actually applies to school children too. In the U.S., we have a big emphasis on the length of the school year and summer school. And politicians will say, oh, well, the reason this heavily black area is not performing well on tests is because they need to spend more hours in school, right? And that's nonsense, of course, but I think that people deep down, they don't want to say it openly, but they know that school is essentially like a daycare for black kids, right? And so that's what they're doing, is they're sending their kids to school for as long as possible in order to, give the parents a break, essentially, so the parents can do whatever they're going to do and make money or whatever. But it's the idea that you can just, you know, that school is 100%, like the second the student shows up to the moment they leave, they're learning useful, valuable things. It's just so ridiculous. I think maybe looking back on my public school experience, because I did not go to private school, I would say maybe like 15% was actually spent learning. Like the rest of it was just like, you know, goofing off, sitting around doing whatever. Similar things are probably true in many jobs. It's sort of the joke that you'll pass guys who are doing road work, road construction or whatever, and you know, yeah, five of them will be sitting there just observing one of them do the work. I need to look this up, but I'm sure there may be a study or studies that sort of try to estimate what percentage of time people spend at work they're actually getting work done. But it would be interesting to know and how that varies across cultures. I think shame-based cultures like, Germans, I think, and probably the Japanese, and even America, we're more like
shame-based. Germans and Americans are guilt-based.
Yeah.
Shame-based is Japanese, Chinese, the people who save face, whereas white people, we have the angel and the devil on our shoulders, so
yeah.
We weigh moral decisions.
Right. Yeah, I think Germans are being more inclined to work 100% of the time might be an outgrowth of the white guilt. You know, the it's like, well, I'm on the clock, and so if I goof off or I slack, then it's like I'm stealing from my boss or whatever, you know.
I mean, Macedonians, we have the same thought process. We just don't consider stealing from our bosses to be bad. Maybe it's a toxic attitude, but most of the time it's actually true that if someone is that rich, they probably did something to deserve being stolen from. And the tragedy is, right, there are areas of the world, especially, you know, east of the Iron Curtain in the former communist bloc, that where if you see someone and he has money, in all probability, this guy he did something very evil and deserves to be stolen from. So people just steal from him.
Interesting.
And it doesn't really matter if you work hard or not work hard, you're still going to be paid the same wretched pittance. So why not just slack off on the job? And you know, this is what this is basically what destroys societies, what destroys economies. But when you promote absolute scum on the top, it's not that the people can't tell. It's, yes, we do. And when you think about it, boss, the old saying, boss makes a dollar, I make a dime. This is why I sleep on company time. Now, add to that, my boss is an evil fuck. He's a genuinely evil person. Like is the case currently in America and in the United Kingdom.
I think 10, 15, 20 years ago in America, if you had polled conservatives and asked them, you know, what do you think of your boss? Do you think that do you like your boss? I think you'd probably get much, much higher response, you know, higher satisfaction 20 years ago than today. I think because conservatives today have to know that their bosses are not just left wing, but they're like actually anti-white, anti-Christianity, you go down the list of all the anything conservative culture. And it's sort of we've entered into an era where the culture war and the racial war is just so explicit that it's become. We've potentially reached a scary phase where the right is going to start to sympathize with various factions of Marxism. And so, yeah, that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, I wouldn't say Marxism per se. I mean, there is no revolt on the right, from what I can tell, against the rich or the capital holders. There is a revolt against the shitlips, right? That you're this right. class overlaps with the rich and the capital holders. I mean, it's going to certainly influence the decision-making process, because let's say your boss is a shitlib and you work very hard and you make him an extra dollar, he's going to give it to BLM or the ADL, yeah. or he's going to donate it to a Democratic politician who's just going to allow school teachers to brainwash your children into becoming transsexuals.
Yeah.
Are you really going to work that hard? And another thing is, right, people are, there is no upward mobility anymore, or very mm-hmm. little. You know, why are you working hard? So you can be at the same place in 50 years and just some scum on top are going to get richer. These are not Marxist ideas. This is basically very conservative. You want a square deal. I work, I get paid. There is a certain deal here, and you're not holding up your end. If I work harder, you're going to make my life harder.
Yeah. And I mean, these like, the challenge is that now, like in Europe, that's certainly the case. But the challenge is that in America, when you use that type of language, that's immediately you're hit with sort of the Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck type of conservative reaction, which is, no, that's capitalism, and capitalism is what made America great. And it's like the Protestant work ethic thing. But I think, you know, I'm optimistic that type of knee-jerk reaction is finally starting to be, people are finally starting to get weaned off of that. And it's not a difficult case to make anymore. Like when people, you know, it used to be that, you know, if your boss was also a right winger, then, you know, you're not going to be very amenable to those types of ideas. But if your boss is a shitlib, then yeah, you're going to, you know, you're going to react in a way that's going to be much more sympathetic with the European side of the European way of thinking about work, which is a great thing. I think that, you know, I think America, you know, I would, as an American, I would happily sacrifice a few percentage points of GDP in order for people to, have a more pro-free time, pro-family point of view. We need to abolish the Protestant work ethic. It's just not good for anybody.
Yeah. And it is really an unnatural way of looking at things, right? And traditional Christian theology would actually call this a sin of excess, right?
Right.
There is such a thing as being making a fetish, and I'm using here fetish in the traditional sense. You know,
right,
you're making an idol of labor. You're making an idol of your work and its fruits, which are money and whatever else. Whereas you have to remember that you're doing this for a reason. You're doing it for money, right?
Right.
Why do you need money? Because you need to live in the world. It was like we were talking about job interviews with friends, and someone like, what inspired you to seek work with our company? And the guy just said, money. And I need money. I know how to work. So I was thinking I would work in exchange for money.
Well, you could turn the tables on them and ask them, well, what inspired you to put out this open position and try to ask people to apply? Well, it was clearly because you wanted to make money.
I mean, I wrote something about this recently. Basically, it was about team building. I was forced to participate in team building exercises back when I was a wagee. And I say I yearn for the time when work was really just a commercial transaction, time for money, or labor for money. It's, I don't want to be friends with people I see at work. I can barely stand them as it is. I'm sorry. I'm just not a sociable person.
I wonder, I kind of wonder if that whole team building thing might also be related to feminism too. Like, you know, as women enter the workforce has to become more social. And
yeah, it is. And you see, it's basically being driven by these HR hens, right? Because the reality of it is people go to work so that they can work and they can take home a paycheck with which they can pay their bills and do whatever they do with their money, right? This whole idea of, oh, we're a team, we need to work together. You put a bunch of men in a room together and tell and give them a problem and the tools to solve it, and they will solve the problem, and this will build the team, right? Men are better friends when they work, become better friends when they work together towards a common goal,
right?
Than when hanging out. I mean, if I really just wanted to hang out with someone, I go to the nearest bar, I sit down right on the bar, and the guy next to me, I can have a conversation with him, which is unrelated to anything difficult, you know?
Yeah,
it's a stranger in a bar, but if you want to build a team, you got to have common problem solving, especially if you have men. Now, I don't know how women function because I don't think anyone's ever expected of women to solve problems together or in isolation.
Right.
And especially not in conjunction with men. What I suspect is going on with those team building exercises is basically HR hands have nothing to do, so they feel useless. So they invent work for themselves, which
gets
in everyone's way.
Yeah. That's another problem is that, you know, it's like, it's sort of the same principle as what's causing, you know, universities in the West to become, overwhelmingly, female and left wing is that, you know, and I see these arguments from people on both sides that you know, really both sides make a lot of sense. I'm kind of torn on it. I think that, you know, some people will say, well, the right should not abandon the universities and shouldn't give up on trying to, you know, get degrees. And then the other people will make the case that, well, you shouldn't go to university unless you absolutely have to in order to learn something very specific. But the general trend, I think that, it, you know, is, eventually it's going to crack. I just can't imagine that it's going to, you know, this sort of feminization of, like, you know, universities and work is going to keep up forever. I just think that, and particular in science, like I was having this discussion the other day with my friend who's a chemist, and he's actually a PhD, and he works in a team, and he works with women, and he, you know, he complains to me about having to work with these women. They actually tell him, you know, when you write a paper, like a scientific paper, you are expected now to, you have to cite, women in the paper. Like there's certain number of citations that have to be female. And that's like a requirement. And so now the papers that are being pumped out, are sort of artificially boosting female contribution to science, which, I mean, you know, that's not the end of the world, but you know, ultimately it points toward I guess it's just one more indication that, you know, the quality of science is declining because it's sort of like people are just sort of trying to eke out career goals versus actual scientific progress. And I have some, I think that's, as it becomes more widely known that that's happening, the social, catch it for scientists will, you know, plummet further than it already is, which is fine by me. I mean, I don't, you know, I think that, you know, trust the science is not, you know, in some cases there is valid good science, but I think that in general it's better to have a skeptical polity than a a polity that's going to go along with anything. I'd rather, let me just put it this way. I would rather be stuck in 2008 technology for the rest of my life, and also that politics, than to be continually marching leftward in politics with the technological progress. I think the technological stagnation is preferable to the cultural stagnation, but we'll see how it plays out.
I guess one last objection we could bring forward for nuclear energy or geothermal or any kind of energy is that all of these ways of deriving energy from the environment really rely on a concentration of very high IQ people who know what they're doing, and especially nuclear energy, right?
Right.
So, and this is, of course, we are not living in a time where we have an excess of nuclear physicists. We are living in a time where IQs are declining across the West, not just because of immigration. The white population is getting dumber because of dysgenic pressures.
Right.
We are having a situation where even among intelligent white people, science is being degraded by things like you mentioned and other factors as well. Government and corporate control of the scientific process, which favors basically this inquisition process they have of grant getting, and now they're forcing scientists to cite women, and pretty soon they'll be forcing them to cite blacks and Mexicans and whatever. And this is not really the time to switch to a source of energy where a single mistake, where basically people being morons, can lead to hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of lives lost.
Right. Or even, equally worse, equally bad would be, the land just simply being unusable for 1,000 years. Yeah. I mean, that's terrible,
I mean, you saw the Chernobyl miniseries, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so essentially Chernobyl was the nuclear disaster was a result of, people being morons, people ignoring scientific truth in favor of ideological benchmarks. This was specifically Soviet and Russian, right? The Russians are obsessed with dates and industrial achievement as a source of patriotism, right? But we have our own brand of insanity in the West, and it's going to be pretty nasty. I mean, imagine American Chernobyl happening because someone thought of putting a black woman as the chief technician, right? You're not going to have Dyatlov to kick around. No, it's going to be the strong, independent black woman nuclear physicist who does not know which end of an atom to hold. I'm just painting a bright picture of the future. The future's gonna be so bright.
Now we understand why Klaus Schwab is so gung-ho about windmills, because he doesn't trust putting black women in charge of nuclear.
Yeah, I want to see what I suspect that black woman designed windmills would just spin apart and decapitate every bird within the county on the fifth day.
Right.
But it is right. The future is going to be so bright. We're not even going to have eyes in the future, because we will be born without them due to irreparable damage to our DNA, because we just had to have a black woman nuclear physicist. Just another white pill for you people, just keeping things positive on the block, keeping it like we did classy and everything. We have a donation. We have $5 American from Reed Johnson over on, it's not Entropy, it's Odyssey. He says, "Thank you, Carl, for being our guest today. This has been a rather productive episode of the Writer's Block. Please join us again sometime soon."
I shall. Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
thank you for that.
It's definitely appreciated. I love having these conversations with Carl, because usually I have to put in a lot of effort into a show, but with Carl we just get gel together. Both of us are massive science nerds, so this is very relaxing for me as well. I hope the audience enjoys it too. And we have some comments in the chat. Now, they're not bought and paid for. Okay, we have another donation, this time from Redline, for $10 on Entropy. And he says, thank you, thanks for all you do. Well, thank you, sir, for supporting Countercurrents and the show. It is greatly appreciated, and your comments in chat are also appreciated. And we have here, Bartolo 67. He says Chernobyl was the result of the Peter Principle, Soviet style. No, Bartolo. The whole point of Chernobyl is because Peter Principle means you get promoted until you're out of your depth. But I don't think that was the case there. Right? The problem with Chernobyl was that they rushed the test, right, when the nuclear power plant was already engaged, right? They had power requirements. They had to keep it on, but they were already behind on the test. So they decided to do the test while the power plant was still at full capacity. And this is what caused the disaster, along with shoddy design, right? So it was actually also poorly designed, you know, Soviet quality. So there was that. And yeah, people just seem to be completely missing what the Peter Principle is. I might actually have to. I've never heard of that before.
I didn't know the Peter Principle was a thing.
Yeah, there's basically the Peter Principle is you get promoted until you get overpromoted, right? Until you get promoted to a point where you're actually pretty bad at your job.
Because I see. Because
you're in way over your head.
Yeah,
and it actually has an opposite, which is the Dilbert principle. You promote the absolute retards to keep them away from workflow.
I see.
Yeah, although there is a method to the madness over there. Now, the Prussian Army manual says that people who are intelligent but lazy should be put in command because they don't panic in times of crisis because they have a naturally phlegmatic temperament.
Interesting. Wow.
I mean, if you basically the problem of the HR hen is a problem of a person with low IQ but who is very driven, who is very hardworking. If we had everything we have right now, but all of our HR hens were deeply lazy and content to just, you know, collect their paychecks and do nothing, right?
Yeah.
Companies would still function. They would just have one superfluous employee. Whereas,
well, yeah, and yeah. You know, it's my, I mean, I think that like these white women who have all these office jobs, in particular like HR and stuff, you know, they can actually be contributing to society in like a really positive way. But, you know, yeah, like their current position is one where they're actually, you know, negative contributors. They need to be in some sort of a task where they're doing something that's somehow improving quality of life, like you know, a beautification of a town square or something like that. But yeah.
Yep. And that seems to be the case. We have one last minute donation from Where is Waldo? He has given us one diamond over on DLive, and that is greatly appreciated, sir. Let me just check if I missed any donations, although I do not, I doubt, yeah, there are no new donations. So if Carl would like to give his closing remarks and we can end the show.
Yeah, everybody can find me on Telegram. You can, actually, I would enjoy it if you join my channel too, because it's, if you join, we actually have a good discussion group that's linked to it. So it's, t.me/BitcoinBBQ, and we'll see you there.
Right. I'm in the chat too as well. You can always find me there goofing off and generally being the village idiot of Telegram. But followed Carl on Telegram, and he's actually pretty good. He's been following the crypto markets. I've been tracking his impending nervous breakdown for about 2 years now. It's going to be amazing when it happens.
Yeah, it's going to be fireworks.
literally, maybe, you know, some people might set off fireworks.
right.
So I guess this has been the writer's block. People, I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey. And the replay of this show will be up on Countercurrents sometime later next week. And of course, you can listen back to it if you have paid our paywall. If you have not done so, please get behind our paywall. All the interesting stuff is happening behind the paywall. We might even have a perpetual mobile machine over there, or you would never know unless you actually got into the paywall. And I want to thank everyone who donated. You are what makes Countercurrents possible. You are what makes this show possible. Thank you for that. My hat is off to you, or it would be if I had a hat on. And I want to thank also everyone who chatted tonight in the chat. Great banter, great conversations. We are bringing back the art of conversation, of learned discourse. Salon culture is back big style, or bigly, as Trump would say. I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators who have kept the chat safe and provided all of the relevant links so that everyone can access them with ease. Thank you, Reed Johnson, Bartleby, and Gadius Maximus. This show would be quite impossible without you. And with that, I want to thank Carl. Carl, you were our guest, and you're indispensable when it comes to these science-y type subjects.
Yes, indeed. Thanks, Nick. And I'll be back on whenever you want me on.
So I guess this is it. Bye-bye, people.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.